So, Dr. Pete, are you with us?
Yep.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for your time on the show. Like I said, we'll go through what I'd like to ask you about with regards to the endocrine system, and then there are some questions posed by callers. So, Dr. Pete, I guess without further ado, I'd saw where we'd left off last month, and we just got started into the hypothalamus, and I brought out one of the things that struck me as kind of unusual, but I wanted to ask you a little bit more about it. So from last month, breaking the question, what is a hormone and how the endocrine system regulates metabolism, you discussed thyrotropin-releasing hormone, which stimulates TSH from the anterior pituitary, as well as prolactin. Now, prolactin is a hormone that's responsible for lactation in females. And so is there another mechanism, perhaps, to satisfy the TSH production in low thyroid individuals to upregulate the T4 production, which does not result in increased prolactin production? So for those of you who are listening, perhaps, the TSH is a thyroid-stimulating hormone, and this is basically stimulated at the same time as prolactin is. So in low thyroid individuals, my question to you, Dr. P, is the potential for women to be exposed to higher than normal levels of prolactin, and have you known women that would lactate when they weren't, you know, nursing or outside of, you know, well, not outside of menstruation, but when women weren't fertile or nursing? Is this something that you've actually found?
Yeah, probably maybe 100 women that I've talked to who were simply hypothyroidism was their basic problem, but unwelcome lactation was just one of their symptoms. And usually there were menstrual irregularities at the same time, either too much or too little menstruation. And just correcting their thyroid function took care of the lactation and menstruation both. And what it's doing is partly it's regulating oxygen metabolism so that you can use your fuel very efficiently, keep your blood sugar steady so that you don't experience stress. Estrogen is in good health. It's produced for about 12 hours once a month in a big surge to basically create tissue stress to stir up cell division to prepare the uterus and the breast and the other tissues. The pituitary are the main things that are activated by estrogen. Low thyroid, by letting you get low blood sugar inappropriately, at the same time, it's activating the stress hormones and inactivating the parts of the liver that are normally destroying estrogen as soon as estrogen reaches the liver.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, the small amount of estrogen being produced under moderate stress is kept very low by an active liver when the thyroid is activating the liver.
Okay.
When the thyroid is low, estrogen tends to rise, and both of these tend to create an oxygen deficiency and a glucose deficiency. One intensifies the other, and these are the first step in any kind of stress reaction. And the stress reaction turns on your pituitary as a way to organize the adaptive system of the body.
Okay.
Prolactin in fish, prolactin regulates salt and water metabolism, and mammals have various components of milk formation involving both the flow of water and salts, but including proteins and sugar and such. So prolactin in all animals has a range of anti-stress functions, and lactation is just a useful component for handling the stress of pregnancy, fertility.
I picked up on what you said about estrogen being a once monthly, a 12-hour period, a once monthly surge. But I just want to ask you this. It seems a very ubiquitous poison, for want of a better word, that women are continually subjected to. How can you compare that to the background levels of estrogen that you are always advising women to protect themselves from, either environmentally or with, things like pregnenolone or progesterone, if they have excessive inflammation going on in the body from different causes?
Any tissue of your body that is stressed will start to produce estrogen. Right. It's a very basic reaction to stress. And so with aging, for example, when you've lost some of your basic anti-stress hormones, thyroid and progesterone and pregnenolone, then all of your tissues are suffering from oxygen and glucose, bad metabolism. They're simply not interacting properly. And that means that all of your tissues will begin producing a little bit of estrogen. For example, the postmenopausal breast tissue is producing several times more estrogen than it does during menstruation.
Interesting.
And if the liver slows down because the thyroid is low, then that little bit that's been being produced by any stressed tissue is going to pile up in the blood because it should be eliminated constantly through the liver and kidney.
Interesting. This brings me back to some of the reasons for wanting to cover some of this endocrine stuff with you, is that I think, and it's a little bit, it ties into your newsletter, funnily enough, like a lot of things do. In terms of the brainwashing that science has been guilty of, brainwashing the public into deceiving them to believe that things are a certain way, when actually there's previous research that showed exactly the opposite. That's been buried, it's been closed up, and money's been diverted away from it and diverted towards the wanted information. So again, when I was studying, I was under the impression that basically the ovaries were the main estrogen secreting organ in the female body, and that really men didn't really have estrogen. It wasn't, men had testosterone, females had estrogen. Things were fairly simple. But actually, it's really very different from that. And hearing that, I think you said any cell can essentially secrete estrogen in response to stress and inflammation.
Yeah, and old men get low testosterone because their stressed tissue is turning it quickly into estrogen.
Right. This is aromatization, right?
Yeah. And a younger man who is very sick or has an accident will have very high estrogen.
Right.
And that will bring up usually prolactin and growth hormone and a lot of adaptive secondary hormones.
Interesting. So I think hopefully by continuing, some other little tidbits will come out that people will pick up on and maybe start looking into things further themselves. I wanted to, again, just to get back briefly to that first question about lactation and prolactin being secreted in females and actually causing some milk production. Is it a quantitative issue, or, where there's not enough prolactin being stimulated by the release of TRH, or is oxytocin, for example, a more powerful stimulator of lactation or not?
Oxytocin really is just to release the milk once it's formed. Right. It isn't involved in directly in forming it.
Right. It's a suckling response.
When I was a little kid during the Depression, there were very poor people moving into Southern California, and some of them were finding jobs. And one family we knew, the mother was able to find a job when they had a baby that was a few months old. And the father, they'd been starving for years, and the father was able to lactate to nurse the baby while the mother was at work.
Wow. Do you see any difference? Out of interest, do you see any difference in the quality of the milk? Or?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Men aren't nearly as good at lactating.
Not as much fat, maybe.
And it's a very extreme thing.
Yeah.
Lots of men, when they came out of the World War II prison camps, when they started eating, they got enough energy to mobilize cortisol and some thyroid and such. They began lactating because they had injured their tissues much that they were very high in estrogen.
Wow. I mean, it's well documented now, certainly not hidden, but that male breasts or gynecomasty is a common phenomenon in males that are exposed to estrogen. And from the industry in England, the beer drinking, it's not uncommon for men that drink a lot of beer daily to grow basically breasts. And I mean, even in this country, related to estrogen substances, whether it's the hops, that the estrogen mimics in hops, or even environmental mimics in plastics, etc., that get into the environment, that some more sensitive individuals are being exposed to.
Yeast can produce estradiol, and so they think that the yeast fermenting is a major source of breast development in beer drinkers.
Interesting. So it may not necessarily be down to the humulone, lupulone, or the other byproducts of the hop.
They're probably not as harmful as the yeast-produced estrogen.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, you're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor on KMED Galbaville 91.1 FM. We're joined with Dr. Pete, who's on the show, basically questioning the endocrine system and what we understand about it, and finding out some certain differences and contradictions that perhaps people understand the facts by until they hear differently. The number, if you're in the area, is 707-923-3911. Or if you're outside the area and would like to ask Dr. Pete any questions, from 7:30 on, there's an 800 number, which is 1-800-KMUD-RAD, which is 1-800-568-3723. So let's move on to the next hormone in the hypothalamic section of this endocrine discussion, the corticotropin-releasing hormone. How this stimulates adrenocorticotropic hormone from the pituitary, the anterior pituitary, and this acts on the adrenals to promote and secrete cortisol. Now, most people have probably heard of cortisol if they're at all health-minded. Cortisol, cortisone, hydrocortisone, they're all kind of derivatives. Most of these derivatives here have at some point in time and or are still being used to control inflammation. And I've known asthmatics and eczema patients and psoriatic patients that have been prescribed cortisol and corticosteroids to control that. The natural production of cortisol is inhibited by a negative feedback mechanism, so we're never normally, naturally, constantly and chronically exposed to cortisol. It obviously has some beneficial effect, although I understand your interpretation puts a far more negative view of cortisol, probably in relation to its chronic exposure. But what dangers do you see in the chronic use of hydrocortisone, either topically or aerosolized, and what would be a better approach to quell inflammation then of this type that you're aware of?
Within the first 2 or 3 hours of a big dose of cortisol or the synthetic glucocorticoids, the thymus gland starts shrinking, and the skin and muscles begin shrinking as the cortisol shifts the metabolism in the opposite direction of testosterone.
Towards the estrogenic side?
They activate the proteolytic enzymes that break down the proteins and inhibit the anabolic protein synthesizing mechanisms. The brain, heart, and lungs are very concentrated testosterone metabolizers and retainers. If you give someone radioactive testosterone, you see the emission from those organs, most of it from the heart and the brain. The lungs are so full of air, you don't see much radiation. But the testosterone is there protecting these vital organs. But when you give a big dose of cortisol, you swamp that protective effect of progesterone and testosterone. Wow. And the tissues that aren't very well protected very quickly shrink. Mm-hmm. Your skin becomes thinner. Blood vessels weaken. You tend to get the little bloody spots, petechial hemorrhages, okay. and bruise very easily. Lots of women have constantly bruised thighs and sometimes upper arms because of the if they're low in thyroid and progesterone, then they compensate with increased cortisol, mm-hmm. which weakens their small blood vessels, and they bruise easily. If that continues over the years, it leads to strokes and osteoporosis and the typical aging conditions.
I've known people in England especially that, I don't know whether or not the doctors there were just more readily prescribing aerosolized inhalants, corticosteroid inhalants for asthma and or topical creams for eczema, but it was the only thing that was ever really done. And I've known people that have been on these things for years and years, and I'm sure to their detriment. You're saying it's essentially switching off the protective anti-excitotoxic mechanism and route by which inflammation typically, or estrogen-induced inflammation, is mediated.
Yeah, and asthma is one of the typical estrogen-induced inflammations. High estrogen women are very susceptible to asthma, especially during the night. And one of the effects of estrogen is to directly stimulate the adrenal glands to produce cortisol. So high estrogen leads to weak blood vessels and shrinking bones and aging skin and low immunity and such by the shrinking effect of cortisol on the thymus gland. And estrogen activates, shifts the balance towards serotonin away from dopamine. And this shift in the serotonin-dopamine ratio is one of the things that activates the prolactin system, mm-hmm. and it also, serotonin is one of the major activators of the corticotropic release hormone, CRH.
Right.
So estrogen activates the pituitary, the hypothalamus, the adrenal glands directly to increase the tissue breakdown effect.
Okay, so yeah, I caught on what you said about female asthmatics getting particularly worse at night, and this, again, I guess this is nighttime stress that worsens the inflammation?
All of the stress
low
hormones
blood sugar.
Rise during the night.
Right, and again, in response probably to low blood sugar because of fasting or...
Hypoglycemia or disturbed oxygen availability increase both prolactin and usually growth hormone. Stress induces, I think, all of the pituitary hormones except for luteinizing hormone, the one that produces testosterone and progesterone. So when you activate the all of the other parts of the pituitary, you're likely to become sterile by losing your progesterone and testosterone.
I think from a male perspective, it's for those males that are listening, I know we do tend to get more female listeners that I think intuitively are more nurturing and, I don't know, empathic maybe. But for the guys that are out there, I think testosterone is extremely important to reiterate. Not just the prostatic involvement with decreased testosterone, but to maximize your testosterone is the best thing that you can do as a guy, because it is the counterpart to estrogen and it is the anti excitotoxic route by which inflammation is quelled, and the body's governed by a orderly system of growth and sugar metabolism, etc.
It's close enough in function to progesterone in protective tissues. They've experimented removing the ovaries from rats after they've been impregnated, and then giving them testosterone during pregnancy. It is a progestin in that sense of being able to sustain pregnancy in the absence of ovaries.
Well, I guess we do actually have a caller, so let's. I'll pick up this question I wanted to ask you about testosterone for the males that are listening, just to help them see their way forward through any lack of muscle and muscle building, and how testosterone is really very beneficial for you, and you can generate it yourself. You don't have to buy it, et cetera, et cetera. So let's take this first caller. Caller, you're on the air, and where are you from?
Hi, I'm from the San Francisco Bay Area.
Okay, hi, what's your question?
I'm wondering, can an imbalance of hormones influence someone's perception of his or her gender? I'm curious, as I'm certain we're constantly exposed to environmental estrogens, and I've also heard of instances like Caitlyn Jenner, where Bruce Jenner knew from a very young age that he was the opposite gender. So what's your take on that?
Yeah, Dr. Pete?
When that happens during gestation or in the first few months after being born, the actual cell structure of the brain is still going on, and it's either masculinized or not by the presence of testosterone, which is turned into estrogen, and estrogen in those stages of development is the masculinizing hormone. And so a deficiency of progesterone early in life leaves the estrogen unopposed and tends to masculinize the brain. And so it can set up the feeling the gender that is chemically activated rather than what the chromosomes were
The physical
able to do.
Does that answer your question?
That does. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Okay, well, let's see here. We do have another caller. So let's take this caller, next caller. You're on the air. What's your question and where are you from?
Yes, good evening.
You don't sound...
I'm calling from Finland.
Okay, I'll finish with you.
I would have a question. I've been reading your wonderful Generative Energy book, and basically, it's prompted me to think about what I think they call now transhumanism. Nowadays, we have basically the modern version of the $6 million man. We have people with robotic hands. A friend of mine with Parkinson's disease has two chips implanted in his brain with remote control. And my question to Dr. Pete would be, do you believe that this transhumanism might fit into future evolutions of man? You know, I'm referring to this theory about life trending towards maximum metabolism, maximum energy. I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
I think the technology is so simplified compared to what actually is needed by the organism to maximize its metabolism and function and experience that I don't think the technology is going to have a role in future development of health, longevity, or brain development.
It's certainly not going to be passed on to the next generation, so it's certainly a very temporal thing. And I think from my perspective, the human body. And I think the psyche plays a much bigger part in the protection and the development of the human organism, far more than perhaps people give real credit to, for positive thinking, et cetera, self-empowerment, doing the right thing in terms of everything that you propose in terms of nutrition and or some of the few supplements that you recommend, things like thyroid and progesterone and things that protect the anti-inflammatory side, then I think we have a far better chance of living a genetically very healthy life, and something that I think that can be passed on to next generations. And certainly we hear about in utero effects onto the fetus. I've often wondered, I'm fairly interested about the transhumanism subject with, like the callers mentioned, things like robotic replacements and or chips to secrete or to prompt secretion of neuropeptides, et cetera, into the brain or other areas. But it doesn't continue. It's just a very temporal thing. I don't think it's something that can ever be transmitted. But what can be transmitted is a mental state of mind that is based on positive thinking, creating that and harmony, and, you know, whether it's yoga or doing, you know, exercise and getting outside and just appreciating everything that you have around you rather than looking at negative things, which I do hear people calling about from time to time, in terms of help with negative emotions, and how it's actually one of the questions, funnily enough, later on for the show. But this is something that can
I ask a follow-up question?
Go ahead, yeah.
I was wondering about, because this is a topic that I haven't heard on the show yet, but we're also in an increasingly hairless society. Uh-huh. People want to shave more and more of their bodies more and more regularly. Well, how stressful is frequent shaving to the body, in your opinion?
Well, it's interesting you say that. I'll just jump in there, Dr. Pete, before I let you answer. But I read the article just a couple of days ago. Actually, it was on the Drudge Report. It was that the increasing hairiness of females is actually is becoming recognized in polls. I think they did a poll in 2004. I think 95% of females shaved. They did a recent poll here. I think it was down to 78, and they were saying that essentially there was more au naturel was becoming more normal. Whether or not you're talking about the hair on a male's head from a baldness perspective, I don't know, caller. But Dr. Pete, what do you think about the?
I think the hair on the head actually has the function of preserving heat, helping to keep the brain warm. Wearing a wool hat will substitute somewhat for not having enough hair on the head. And the other hair, armpits and pubic hair, mm-hmm. I think that has the function of helping to distribute pheromones.
Right.
Somewhat the
like
the hair,
antenna.
Facial hair and arm hair probably has that pheromone distributing function.
Yeah.
But I think the body hair that is tending to appear more often in women is a sign of stress that it's probably related to that pheromone system shifting to an exaggerated steroid production in the skin.
Okay, well, thanks for your caller.
Thanks for the show.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for calling in. For people who want to call in with any questions, if you're in the area, 923-3911. That's a 707-923-3911. Or if you're outside somewhere in the States or even in a different country, 1-800-KMUD-RAD, 1-800-568-3723. So, Dr. Pete, just to carry on with testosterone a little bit, it's a bit of a divergent question, but in terms of men being able to maximize their testosterone production without thinking they have to go to the gym and get aerobic and pump huge amounts of weights to build muscle, what would you say would be a good program for a male who wanted to increase lean muscle mass in order to be exposed to more testosterone? Because it's the muscle itself that will actually promote a testosterone surge in the body, and by its own mechanism will directly relate back to testosterone itself.
Muscle contraction activates the synthesis locally in the muscle of testosterone and decreases the cortisol activity. So good physical work is probably the central thing to keeping your testosterone up. It shouldn't be episodic, intense, stressful
right.
work. That is known to lower your testosterone and increase cortisol.
Yeah.
And at the same time, keeping your metabolic rate up so that you can do more intense activity without it being stressful. Having your liver very healthy
stocked.
Is essential for keeping your mm-hmm. testosterone up, because otherwise the episodes of falling blood sugar
yeah.
activate cortisol, estrogen, all of the other stress hormones.
Yeah. Okay, so stocking your liver with plenty of sugar, not being aerobic about your approach to exercise, and ideally having more of a kind of a work approach that is a physical type of work,
yep.
if you're possibly able. Okay. So moving, moving on to dopamine, I wanted to ask you a little bit. I know we've mentioned the discussion related to Parkinson's and Parkinsonisms. We said that this dopamine itself inhibits prolactin release and helps regulate emotional responses, and their reward and pleasure response is something I wanted to ask you about. This enables a person not only to see the rewards, but to take action to move towards them. And lack of dopamine has been cited and implicated in the propensity to addiction. If you want to feel better, and mood-enhancing drugs are a route to this, does this imply that many addicts have naturally low levels of dopamine and may develop Parkinson's-type symptoms in future? And would dopamine supplementation be useful to wean addicts or prevent addictive behaviors from developing?
I think that even in Parkinson's disease, I think the studies are moving towards thinking of a balance between serotonin and dopamine and the other symptoms.
So you're thinking of serotonin excess might exacerbate?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They are somewhat antagonistic. For
right.
example, serotonin increases the CRH and prolactin. Mm-hmm. Dopamine tends to inhibit them. And
so this bad bowels or bad bowel function or poor elimination would certainly speed that serotonin excess up, wouldn't it?
Nitric oxide, endotoxin, and serotonin all shift your body towards distress. And progesterone and its derivatives in the brain, allopregnanolone, for example,
okay.
Are important for keeping the balance in the right direction. Estrogen increases the serotonin and stress. Progesterone tends to reverse that and increase the balance towards dopamine.
So do you think, though, that this would be any reason or cause for Parkinson's down the road, though? Perhaps if people have addictive natures, if it is at all connected with lack of dopamine?
I think you can correct it most safely with progesterone and testosterone, or the precursor of both of those, pregnenolone.
Sure. Yeah.
Because when you try to push the dopamine system,
yeah.
You tend to increase oxidative damage.
Right. Yeah.
And it's safe to work at the anti-stress level rather than pushing the end product of dopamine.
Got it. So improve muscle mass, plenty of sugars, then obviously pregnenolone, thyroid, all helpful and anti-inflammatory aspects.
Yeah, and keeping the toxic fats down
right.
and sugar stable.
Yeah. Okay, so can I ask you about growth hormone? So the growth hormone releasing hormone stimulates growth hormone release from the pituitary, again, from the anterior pituitary. And this has regulatory effects on protein, carbohydrate, and lipid metabolism, as well as promoting slow-wave sleep, often referred to as deep sleep. And I know people that perhaps have sleep issues where they're unable to get into that phase of deep sleep. I did read that the slow-wave sleep was apparently but I know this is not particularly true because I know you think it's very much related to low blood glucose. But the slow wave sleep was implicated in nightmares and sleepwalking, especially when sleepwalking was joined to raiding the fridge at night and to eat. I found that quite a bizarre connection, but I think it's been well known in popular culture. I've even seen, I remember an old advert back in 1970 for R. White's Lemonade, and the advert was more or less this person was getting out of bed and was sleepwalking downstairs to the fridge where he'd go open the fridge door and there'd be a bottle of R. White's Lemonade there, and he would sit there drinking it and his wife would come down saying, "What's going on?" But anyway, between the desires to eat, sleepwalk, and growth hormone, do you think the deep sleep that it relates to is in any way? Do you think this is a real subject, or do you think this has been again mismanaged scientifically?
No, I think deep sleep is important as a restorative part of your brain function.
Yeah,
and I think a lot of people would be happier and healthier if they would eat during the night. People who resist eating near bedtime or during the night often have more stress, more hypoglycemic insomnia, and most people can get back to sleep if they have, it could be orange juice or lemonade or milkshake or ice cream or
it's almost a cultural barrier. Where there's this feeling that if you eat close to bedtime, you're just going to put it on as fat. I think I've certainly heard that doctrine that excess carbohydrates are stored as fat, which I don't know that it's completely inaccurate. But the nighttime stress that is achieved by lowering your blood glucose is probably offset by the very fact that you're going to consume some glucose before you sleep.
It's very important to restore your glycogen level during sleep. I think that's one of the main purposes of sleep, is to get the glycogen back into your brain cells and heart cells and other tissues, that so that you can expend it to resist stress during the daytime.
Right. Okay. Well, let me just move on to a few questions that I have. I know people have written in that wanted to get your take on this. I had two questions from one listener. One of the questions goes, did Jimmy Carter's cancer cure have anything to do with receptors? Isn't the entire cell a receptor? ?
I think he was having a standard chemotherapy for a while and then brain radiation.
Oof.
And then he got this new antibody that is specific for allowing cells to undergo the normal apoptosis. Statistically, it doesn't look like it was a terribly impressive cure, because the number of people studied was not very big, and the percentage who responded well, I think it was 24%, had a temporary regression of the tumors.
Right.
And that happened in a lot of the people who had only the preceding brain radiation.
Okay. All right. Their other question, I wonder that it might be a little bit self-explanatory perhaps, but it says, since gums like carrageenan and xanthan gum are toxic, does the same apply to gums like frankincense and myrrh?
The carrageenan and xanthan are basically polysaccharides. The carrageenan is a sulfated polysaccharide, mm-hmm. and I think all of the sulfated polysaccharides, besides their own heparin, I think all of those are toxic and dangerous. And the xanthan gums and gum arabic and lots of the plant gums are not digestible, but they can support bacterial growth in the intestine, where the carrageenan is specifically pro-inflammatory and very dangerous. The other gums are simply nuisances that tend to increase bacterial growth and gas production and such.
Yeah.
Where the frankincense and myrrh contain lots of anti-inflammatory substances, probably anti-cancer effects, mm-hmm. Some steroid-like molecules, not so different from testosterone and progesterone. They seem to have an anti-inflammatory, anti-proliferation effect on cancer cells.
I wasn't aware of myrrh being used internally, but I've known frankincense for a long time, especially by the Bedouins. They'll chew frankincense straight off the tree in the pearls that it comes formed in when it dries to freshen their breath, and there's a kind of bacteriostatic for their teeth in their mouth.
I've heard of people eating the crude gum ground up just by the spoonful.
Yeah. Okay.
And on the issue of receptors, there are actual proteins that are called receptor proteins, but my position is that since the condition of the cell determines what a particular substance binding to that receptor is going to do to the cell, it isn't as meaningful as some people think to activate a receptor, because it can have opposite effects depending on the history of the cell and the present condition of other cells.
While we're talking about cells, just quickly, what's your view on stem cell technology? Do you think it's a real way forward to turn around degenerative processes? What do you think about stem cells?
Yeah, I think we're full of stem cells, and what we have to do is activate them intelligently.
Yeah. Well, do you think the research is going in the right direction? You probably know more about what is actually being conducted in some of these experiments and see if it's actually reasonably positable to bring about something positive.
Finding out exactly what the kind of stress signal is that activates them. It's already known that many types of stress will activate the maturing of stem cells, and that things like progesterone and testosterone, once they have been activated, will keep them going in the right direction so that they replace tissues rather than replacing cancer. When they kill cancer by radiation or chemotherapy or surgery, the cancer tends to come back even though they remove the tumor completely, because the place where the cancer was has been injured, and it calls out to the body for stem cells to repair the damage. And being damaged itself as a framework, it misdirects the stem cells, so they develop into cancer.
Well, we have a caller that's just called in, so let's take this next caller. Caller, where from, and what's your question?
Hi, my name's Derek. I'm here in Denver, Colorado. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, sounds great. What's your question, Derek?
Well, first off, I just discovered this show not too long ago, and it's fantastic. I really appreciate you taking your time to do this for the public. So I've been into nutrition research for the last 5 years or so, and looking into, I've had a lot of food intolerances, and looking into like gut permeability, and I'm curious, Dr. Pete, your take on, because a lot of these protocols involve avoiding otherwise really nutrient dense foods, eggs, dairy, etc. So I'm curious. I've looked into controlling endotoxin through various polyphenols. I know you talk about the carrot salad and bamboo shoots, but is there any other compounds you like to incorporate to heal or strengthen the lining of the intestines? I know gelatin can be beneficial.
The nutrients that are most important are magnesium and vitamin A. Just for the actual replacement and repair of cells, but the whole range of nutrients, protein, zinc, vitamin D, anti-inflammatory things like vitamin E and vitamin K, everything is really essential ultimately for protecting the intestine. So having liver and eggs and milk and orange juice, for example, can often get the repair going. I think the reason eggs have a bad reputation is that they are extremely concentrated protein, and if a person eats an egg or two without carbohydrate, their blood sugar is going to fall for sure, especially if their liver doesn't have good glycogen stores. The egg will drop your blood sugar. That will activate mast cells, and you'll have allergic reactions. And
that is
fewer protein without the carbohydrate, you're going to increase inflammation. And sugar and progesterone are and aspirin are things that will protect you from those surges of histamine and serotonin, et cetera.
And does the histamine get produced because you don't have enough glycogen due to a cortisol spike then?
Well, low thyroid ultimately is the most common reason for not having enough glycogen stored. The cortisol weakens the tissues so that, even though it helps get your blood sugar up and momentarily protects the glycogen, in the long run, it's adding to the problem of unstable blood sugar. And anytime your blood sugar falls, the mast cells are likely to degranulate. And that's influenced by a lack of testosterone and progesterone, or an excess of estrogen.
And am I correct in understanding that thyroid is oftentimes, or lack of thyroid hormone is oftentimes a root cause of small bowel overgrowth or SIBO, which can be a root cause of leaky gut?
Your digestion slows down when your metabolic rate slows down from hypothyroidism.
Right.
And so your stomach becomes sluggish, doesn't secrete much, and doesn't move fast enough. People might have transit time. They might eat a carrot today, and it might not come out for 4 or 5 days. What happens with hypothyroidism. And speeding up your digestion and secretions, it should be so active, streaming fluid from your stomach and pancreas and liver, should wash your whole small intestine clean so that there no bacteria can thrive in it.
And Dr. P, real quick, I don't want to hold you up too long. Is there a good quality nutrition-based textbook that you find favorable, that kind of gets into good mechanisms with nutrition and hormones and their relation?
Not that I know of.
You can.
Yeah, and that's what's tricky. I mean, I know there's some great online databases for some good research that's put out there, but I just didn't know if you had a recommendation there. I really appreciate your time.
Years ago, I've seen some really good monographs on particular topics, like how the intestine works, how the digestive glands work, and so on. But I don't know of one that has put everything together.
Sure. Well, I guess that's part of the journey. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, you're welcome. If you want to email me, my email address is andrew@westernbotanicalmedicine.com. We've produced a pretty comprehensive 3 or 4 page breakdown of those things that Dr. Pete definitely advocates and those things he definitely doesn't advocate. So that's certainly been very useful in guiding a lot of our clients to a better place. Dr. Pete, thank you so much for joining us again.
Okay, thank you.
For those people who perhaps, like the last caller, have never really listened to Dr. Pieper, just discovered him recently, he can be found on the internet at www.raypeat.com. He has lots of archived and referenced material. So most if not all, of the articles that he writes are fully referenced. And they range in broad terms from thyroid to sugar to progesterone, to diabetes. I mean, it covers a wide range of situations and gives you the scientific rationale behind why he's advocating what he's advocating. So it's not just flippant off the top of his head. It's based on a lot of research and based on a lot of previous good science, which unfortunately is becoming fairly bad science today. And if we get time next month, we'll get into the newsletter that he's produced. It's titled Language and Criticism of Science. We've done quite a few exposés of whether it's Codex Alimentarius after the Second World War and the development of the global corporate structure, which would squat on our necks, to this discourse that Dr. Pieper outlined in his newsletter, mentioning people, organizations such as the CIA and the CCF and the Rockefeller and Ford Foundations all basically being in on it. We'll get into that next month. But for those people who want to find out more about him, raypeat.com. We can always be reached Monday through Friday. Toll-free number is 1-888-WBM-HERB. Or it can be emailed Andrew or Sarah at westernbotanicalmedicine.com. So next month, we hope to be here. I don't have any plans, but I may or may not end up getting off to England. But based on the fact that I'll be here, it's going to be already the solstice, so it's already going to be upon us. So this will be the last month of increasing day length. So between here and the next couple of months, you've got a chance to get exposed to lots of sunshine, get that anti-inflammatory red light, get your vitamin D going. Make sure you're drinking plenty of milk, getting plenty of sugar, fruit juices at night time, keep your stress hormones down, look at your temperature and pulses, see how your thyroid's doing, and address it. It's certainly a very simple way of putting things right. So between your thyroid and anti-inflammatory hormones and get your testosterone up, guys, certainly put you in a better place, all right? And it's all pretty much free of charge, you know? Okay, so thanks for joining us, and we'll speak to you next month.